And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show, coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West, the most haunted city in the country. Well, this is March the 12th, 71st day of the year. 294 days remained of the year's over with. Holidays and observances, which I do by special request. National Girl Scout Day, Allele Immunization and HDFN Day, this deals with, for those that are not familiar with the terms, the immune response is where the body orchestrates a defense against certain challenges. Alrighty, unbelievable. It keeps going to different sites. National Working Moms Day. National Plant a Flower Day. National Organize Your Home Office Day. International Fanny Pack Day. National Baked Scallops Day. World Glaucoma Day. National Science and Engineering Week. Brain Awareness Week. Universal Women's Week. Ramadan. Pulmonary Rehabilitation Week. Birth dates, Liza Minnelli, Ron Jeremy, and Mitt Romney. It's great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, Veggie Month, National Sauce Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Developmental Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Nutrition Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month. I just had my shot of caffeine a few minutes ago. National Umbrella Month, National Kidney Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, National Credit Education Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, Rising Star Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. Well, it's been an interesting review of the news. There's a lot of discussions about the State of the Union address, which was done last Thursday, I think. A lot of the sites are calling the president old yeller because he spent the time yelling. It's being called the snub of the union. The father of GI who was killed in Afghanistan heckled the president, and he was arrested and hustled out of the site. Biden mispronounced the name of Lakin Riley, the 22-year-old Georgia nursing student murdered by the hands of a illegal alien. He can't seem to understand that the American people are not really happy about the kowtowing to the undocumented. I know our local congresswoman, Congresswoman Escobar, I went to her with an issue dealing with actually the violation of the law by the VA. And her office staff told me that I had to understand the needs of the undocumented took precedent over those of disabled veterans, which I was absolutely floored by. He spent the State of the Union time actually doing a campaign speech. He heckled the Republicans from the podium. Every problem he brought up, he laid at Trump's doorstep. Bidenomics, there was a torrent of lies about the economy, inflation, and taxes. Completely ignored the border issue. But everybody applauded and nodded and cheered and carried on like something didn't have good sense. Unfortunately, there are quite a number of issues that need to be addressed, and they weren't. Well, as I say, this is the 12th, in 538, Vitiges, king of the Ostrogoths, ends his siege of Rome and retreats to Ravenna, leaving the city to the victorious Byzantine general Belisarius. 1088, election of Urban II as the 159th Pope of the Catholic Church. He's known for initiating the Crusades. If you notice, the people that get on everybody all stirred up and point them at the enemy doesn't lead the attack. That's for other idiots to do. 1158, the German city of Munich. First mentioned is Forum Apud Munichen in the Augsburg arbitration by the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick I. 1579, started the siege of Maastricht, part of the 80 Years' War. 1622, Ignatius of Loyola and Francis Xavier, founders of the Society of Jesus, are canonized by the Roman Catholic Church. 1689, James II of England landed at Kinsale, starting the Willamite War in Ireland. 1811, the Peninsula War. A day after a successful rearguard action, French Marshal Michel Ney once again successfully delays the pursuing Anglo-Portuguese force at the Battle of Redinha. 1912, the Girl Guides, later renamed the Girl Scouts, are founded in the United States. 1913, the future capital of Australia is officially named Canberra. 1918, Moscow becomes the capital of Russia again after St. Petersburg held this status for most of the period since 1713. 1920, the Cap Push begins when the Marine Brigade Earhart is ordered to march on Berlin. Not a lot is said about the Cap Push, also known as the Cap Ludwigs Push. It was an attempted coup against the German national government in Berlin, named after its leaders, Wolfgang Kapp and Walter von Lüttich. Its goal is to undo the German Revolution of 1918, overthrow the Weimar Republic, and establish an autocratic government in its place, supported by parts of the Reichswehr, as well as the nationalist and monarchist factions. There's a segment of German society who has never accepted the fact that the Kaiser abdicated. In 1928, California, the St. Francis Dam fails. Resulting flood killed 431 people. 1930, Mahatma Gandhi begins the Salt March, a 200-mile march to the sea to protest the British monopoly on salt in India. 1933, Great Depression. Franklin D. Roosevelt addresses the nation for the first time as President of the United States, also the first of his so-called fireside chats. 1938, Anschluss, German troops occupy and absorb Austria. 1940, Winter War, Finland signs the Moscow Peace Treaty with the Soviet Union, ceding almost all of Finnish Karelia. 1940, the most destructive train accident in Finnish history, kills 39 and injures 69 in Turinki, Janakkala. 1942, the Battle of Java ends with the surrender of the American, British, Dutch, Australian command to the Japanese Empire in Bandung, West Java, Dutch East Indies. 1947, Cold War, Truman Doctrine is proclaimed to help stem the spread of communism. The Truman Doctrine, for those who are not familiar with that, it was an American foreign policy that pledged American support for democracies against authoritarian threats. Originated with the primary goal of countering the growth of the Soviet bloc during the Cold War, Truman announced it to Congress on March 12th, 1947. 1947. And it was further developed on July 4th, 1948, when he pledged to oppose the communist rebellions in Greece and Soviet demands from Turkey. Where generally, it implied American support for other nations threatened by Moscow. Led to the formation of NATO in 1949. In fact, historians often use Truman's speech to Congress on March 12, 1947, to date the start of the Cold War. Once again, he wasn't in the field having to deal with it. He was sitting in a nice, luxurious office, spouting doctrines. 1950, the Landau air disaster kills 80 people in the aircraft they were traveling in crashes near Siggingstone, Wales. At the time, this was the world's deadliest air disaster. 1967, Suharto takes power from Sukarno and the People's Consultative Assembly inaugurate him as acting president of Indonesia. 1968, Mauritius gains independence from the United Kingdom. 1971, the 1971 Turkish military memorandum is sent to the Süleyman Demirel government of Turkey, and the government resigns. 1989, Sir Tim Berners-Lee submits his proposal to CERN for an information management system, which subsequently developed into the World Wide Web. 1992, Mauritius becomes a republic, on remaining a member of the Commonwealth of Nations. 1993, several bombs explode in Mumbai, India, killing about 300 people and injuring hundreds more. Also in 1993, North Korea announces it would withdraw from the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons and refuses to allow inspectors access to its nuclear sites. That's suspicious, don't you think? 1999, former Warsaw Pact members of the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Poland joined NATO. That, of course, upset the Soviet Union no end. 2003, Zoran Dindic, Prime Minister of Serbia, is assassinated in Belgrade. 2003, the World Health Organization officially releases a global warning of outbreaks of severe acute respiratory syndrome, that's SARS. 2009, financier Bernie Madoff pleads guilty to one of the largest frauds in Wall Street history. I met him in New York City. I was introduced to him by the man who was I was working for. And I was urged to be more like Bernie Madoff. He was such a wonderful man. 2004, the president of South Korea, Roh Moo-hyun, is impeached by its National Assembly, the first such impeachment in the nation's history. 2009, as I said, financier Bernie Madoff pleads guilty to one of the largest frauds in Wall Street history. 2011, a reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant explodes and releases radioactivity into the atmosphere a day after the 2011 Tohoku earthquake and tsunami. 2014, gas explosion in New York City neighborhood of East Harlem kills 8 and injures 70 others. 2018, U.S. Bangla Airlines Flight 211 crashes at Tribhuvan International Airport in Kathmandu, killed 51 and injured 20. 2019, in the House of Commons, a revised EU withdrawal bill was rejected by a margin of 149 votes. A large segment of the British elected absolutely opposed to withdrawing from the European Union. 2020, United States suspends travel from Europe due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We used to do events all over the country, making the books we write available. That all came to a screeching halt. Of course, the writing didn't, but selling them did. You can now find them on Amazon. And, of course, kenhudnall.com has copies available. Well, we've been talking about some of the deaths in Hollywood. There have been accidents. alcohol and drugs, murders, natural causes. Those have faded into obscurity. Puzzling deaths, suicides, necrology. You know, I was got an email from a listener. We're heard in, I think, 16 different countries. I got an email from a listener wanting me to talk about the death of George Reeves. For those who are not familiar with him, that's the TV Superman. And he was had quite an interesting career. He was one of the Tarleton brothers on Gone with the Wind. And was offered the opportunity to play Superman. And when the series ended, his career came to a screeching halt. He had been typecast, unfortunately. It was going to be resurrected, and he was going to be playing, still be playing Superman, until the fateful night when he, depending on who you talk to, was either murdered or committed suicide. He was born George Besenlo in 1914. You know, it's not just wishful thinking. A lot of people insist that George Reeves did not commit suicide in 1959. Beverly Hills police ruled that his death indicated suicide, but his mother insisted. I'd just spoken to him. He was in a great frame of mind. She couldn't accept that he shot himself while in a drunken, depressed stupor. I mean, you got to be pretty damn drunk to shoot yourself. His best friend, Gig Young, said he was a clean guy and no way capable of bumping himself off. Alan Ladd, who was a friend, said he was never happier. Ironically, later on, Young would commit suicide, and Ladd's death from pills and alcohol was believed to be more suicidal than accidental. Decades later, Reeves' agent, Arthur Weissman, argued that George Reeves' death was not suicide. According to Weissman, what most likely happened was that somebody, most likely at the direction of Eddie Mannix or his wife Tony, who'd had a long affair with George, had replaced the blank in George's favorite gun with a real bullet. Knowing that sooner or later he'd play his usual exhibitionist game of Russian roulette. Now, the true facts of what happened to him will probably never be known, at least not publicly. He was born in Ashland, Kentucky, or Idaho. Athletic. He was 6'2" when he quit growing. Became a contender as a Golden Gloves boxer, but his possessive mother feared he'd get injured. During junior college, he developed a liking for acting, which his overly possessive mother pushed and led to them moving to Los Angeles. It's interesting to note that Superman was a mama's boy. Took acting classes at the Pasadena Playhouse, eventually was spotted by a movie talent scout. Had several movie bits before he was launched in 1939's most prestige film feature, Gone with the Wind, played one of the Frisky Tarleton twins. 1940, married Eleonora Needles, another fledgling actor with whom he met while they were both at the Pasadena Playhouse. They divorced in 1949. His screen career, unfortunately, never really took off. He had small roles in several major features, was cast as several Hopalong Cassidy westerns in the early 40s. His most impressive role was as Claudette Colbert's romantic interest in So Proudly We Hail in 1943. He was in World War II service for a few years, but by the time he returned to the screen, he was on a downhill cycle. The best he could get was playing the lead in a serial in 1949, Adventures of Sir Galahad. Well, he returned to TV work in the late 40s. 51, he appeared in the low-budget film Superman and the Mole Man, which served as the plot for a forthcoming TV series. First batch of 26 segments were shot that year and didn't reach the air until 1952. And they were an enormous hit with youngsters and a lot of adults. And between 53 and 57, 78 other episodes were filmed. That series made George Reeves a well-known personality worldwide. And as a result, he had several screen roles during that time period. But once the series went off the air, George continued with personal appearances as the Invincible Superman. Unfortunately, he was typecast by his TV work and frustrated by the stalemate it created for his career. Then things turned around professionally. At the time of his death, he was scheduled to start an Australian personal appearance tour worth $20,000. And in addition, he was contracted to begin a new Superman TV series in 1960 and to participate in a televised exhibition boxing match with lightweight champion Archie Moore. I mean, he had a lot going for him, and he was extremely optimistic about the future. At the time he died, he's living in Los Angeles on Benedict Canyon in a house bought for him by Toni Mannix, the wife of Lowe's vice president, Eddie Mannix, a man with an unsavory and sinister reputation who once had been number three man at Louis B. Mayer's MGM Studios. George and Toni had a on-again, off-again romance for almost 15 years. During the last months of his life, George received a lot of death threats on his unlisted telephone. He reported the calls to local authorities and wanted to learn that both he and Toni were recipients of telephone threats. And George was also involved in several recent traffic mishaps, which in retrospect could have been murder attempts. The problem is, there was no competent investigation into his death. The assumption was suicide. That makes it easy, case closed. Well, by June of 1959, Reeves was engaged to marry Lenore Lemon, a New York showgirl who'd once been barred from several elite Manhattan clubs for causing trouble. June 15th, 3 days before he and Lenore were to marry, he and Lenore, along with house guest Robert Condon, a writer, were home celebrating the couple's future. About 12:30 in the morning on June 16th, the three went to bed. About 1, two other friends, Carol von Ronkel and William Bliss, in a partying mood, came by the house to partake in the usual drinking and merriment for which Reeves was well known. Lemon admitted the noisy visitors, only to have Reeves come downstairs and argue with them for having shown up at such a late hour. Soon after that, the sulking Reeves went upstairs and, in a joking mood, Lenore quipped, he'll probably go up to his room and shoot himself. A few minutes later, they heard a shot. When they reached the room upstairs, they found Reeves on his bed. He shot himself in the head with his .30 caliber Luger. No suicide note was found. Well, the police investigation concluded his death was an indicated suicide, insisting that the confusing reports of intoxicated house guests made it difficult to draw a cohesive picture of the events. Besides that, Reeves was known for playing with his Luger, simulating a game of Russian roulette. And while speculation ran high about the suicide theory, nobody who might have had the real answer was talking. Reeves, wearing his gray double-breasted suit he used as Clark Kent and Superman, was buried at Forest Lawn Memorial Park in Glendale. His will was probated. Most of his $71,000 in assets, including his house, wasn't left to his fiancée, but it was left to Toni Mannix. Well, Miss Besselow, convinced that her son had been murdered, hired private detectives to investigate the case. They concluded the death was not suicide based on the position of the body and the empty cartridge found under the corpse. The lack of powder burns on the victim's body and from the angle of the entry, exit of the bullet wound in Reeves' head. But no official charges ever brought against anybody. George Reeves' mother died in 1964. Well, after his death, the production company was to make the new Superman series wanted to piece together new episodes using outtakes from earlier Reeves footage and by employing a double. But a very depressed Jack Larson,
He played club reporter Jimmy Olsen on the original series, refused to make the new segment, and the deal fell apart. Years later, long after Eddie Mannix had died, Reeves' one-time agent Arthur Weissman called on Tony Mannix, who was by that point a reclusive Beverly Hills widow. He recalls that during most of the visit, she insisted that they watch reruns of George's Superman series. A few years later, she also died. You know, part of the problem is too many people had too much to lose if it came out that George Reeves was murdered. Tony Mannix was married to Eddie Mannix, and Eddie Mannix was the closest thing to a mobster in Hollywood at that point in time, and he had the connections to get something done. And there's been a lot of stories that I've heard when I lived in California about people getting into Reeves' house, which was empty most of the time. And, in fact, two young men broke in. They were going to... they needed to steal something to get their drug fix. And they claim, in all sincerity, that when they got to the bedroom, George Reeves in his Superman costume was standing there and told them to get out of his house. And supposedly they got. It'd be nice to know for sure what happened to Superman. Well, let's talk about Romy Schneider. Rosemarie Albeck-Retty. As a teenage actress, she was known as the Shirley Temple of German movies. As an adult, she was a talented, beautiful star of the international cinema. Made her Hollywood debut opposite Jack Lemmon in Good Neighbor Sam in 1964. Late 70s, a series of catastrophes turned everything sour for Romy. When she died suddenly in 1982, the media initially concluded she killed herself. Later reports insisted it was a heart attack that ended her life. Well, she was born in 1938 into a theatrical family. Her father was well-known Austrian actor Wolf Albeck-Retty. Her mother was Magda Schneider, the famous German singing star of many movies. 14 Romy, a contractor of Rosemarie, made her screen debut in one of her mother's movies. She continued making pictures, and throughout the 50s, was particularly popular in a series of saccharine movies featuring her as Sissy, Empress Elizabeth. Changed her screen image in 1962 by starring in a segment of Luciano Visconti's Boccaccio, a 70, and Orson Welles' The Trial. Played a whore in The Victors in 1963, but showed a comic touch in What's New Pussycat in 1965 with Peter O'Toole. She married West German actor-director Harry Mayen Haberstock in 1966. Next year, their son David was born. Most of her filmmaking in the 70s was done in France, where she became a star with such pictures as The Things of Life in 1970, Caesar at Rosalie in 1971. The Dirty Hands in 1974, and for the most important thing, Love in 1974. She won France's equivalent of the Academy Award as Best Actress, but this time she was divorced from Haberstock, and she had married in 1975 photographer Daniel Biasini. Her daughter Sarah was born in 1978. Well, 1979, his fortunes began for Romy. Soon after breaking up her marriage to Biasini, her first husband, Harry, committed suicide. Only a few weeks later, Romy underwent surgery for removal of a kidney. July 1981, her 14-year-old son died when he impaled himself accidentally on a wrought iron fence. Well, she went into a deep despondency, particularly over the death of her boy. But she continued making movies, finally making La Passante du Sanssouci, which had been postponed several times because of the various tragedies in her life. Based on Joseph Cassell's novel, the movie dealt with a mother grieving for her dead son. and the picture was dedicated to her late son and his father. Well, by 1982, she had contracts to make three more new movies. But on May 29th, 1982, while La Passante du Sanssouci was enjoying a popular release, the 43-year-old actress was found dead in her Paris apartment. Public prosecutor's office reported that apparently she suffered some kind of cardiac arrest. Although less official sources preferred the more dramatic theory that, unable to cope with life's sadness, she'd killed herself. Initial news headlines detailed that she died from an overdose of barbiturates. June 2nd, 1982. She was buried in the village of Bossy-Saint-Avoir outside of Paris, where she had purchased a home and a cemetery plot recently. Among the 300 people who attended the private service at a local 14th century church, there were film directors Claude Berry and Roman Polanski, actors Jean-Claude Barrault and Michel Piccoli, and Monique Lang, the wife of the French culture minister. You know, it's, no matter how far up the chain you get, there's always the possibility of things coming apart. For Romy Schneider, let's go to Gene Seberg. 1974, writer, diplomat, and filmmaker Romaine Gary said it was ex-wife Jean Seberg. You understand, Jean, you have to understand the Midwest. She emerged from it intelligent, talented, beautiful, but with the naivete of a child. Had the kind of goodwill that, to me, is infuriating. Persistent, totally unrealistic idealism. Made her totally defensive. In the end, it came between us. August 30th, 1979, she was found dead in her car in a Paris suburb. An apparent suicide. November 2nd, 1980, the despondent Romaine Gary killed himself in his Paris apartment by shooting himself in the mouth with the Smith & Wesson 38. Source of this double tragedy can be traced back to 1956 when filmmaker Otto Preminger conducted a nationwide talent search for his upcoming St. Joan, which he did in 1957, and cast Iowa-born Jean Seberg in the lead. Well, Jean Dorothy Seberg was born in Marshalltown, Iowa in 1938, one of five children, two brothers and two sisters. In addition to Jean, the parents were pharmacist Edward and schoolteacher Dorothy Benson Seberg. As an adolescent, seeing a Marlon Brando movie, The Man, in 1950, convinced her that she wanted to be an actress. As a teenager, she did summer stock in Massachusetts and New Jersey and reluctantly attended the University of Iowa for a semester. She was among the national candidates tested by Otto Preminger for St. Joan, and she won that movie role that proved to be a nightmare. During production, Preminger tormented her for the very qualities that made him hire her inexperience and naivete. When released, the drama was badly panned, and a lot of that criticism was leveled at inept Seberg. Nevertheless, the sadistic Preminger used her for her next movie, Bonjour Tristy, 1958. While filming in France, Jean met French attorney Francois Mounier, and they married in September 1957 in her hometown. Unfortunately, that union only lasted for 2 years. But he introduced her to avant-garde movie maker Jean-Luc Godard, who in turn cast her in Breathless in 1959 with Jean-Paul Belmondo. The way picture was a hit, and Jean became a hit with it. Moved back and forth in the 60s between Hollywood and European film projects. 1963, 25-year-old Seberg married Roman Gary, who was twice her age. They already had a son, Alexander, born in July of 62. Now an international star, she made one movie after another. One of her best was The Disturbed Lilith in 1964, opposite Warren Beatty. 1968, her 18-year-old brother David died in a car crash. Airport 1970 proved to be Seberg's last American-made feature. Years later, Gary would say the FBI unfairly sought retaliation on Jean because of her financial donations and political support for assorted black liberal groups such as the Black Panthers during the 60s. It's Gary's contention, the Federal Bureau planted Hollywood gossip column stories in 1970 that Jean, who was in the midst of a divorce from Gary, was pregnant by a Black Panther leader. In actuality, according to Romaine, he was the father. Seberg became so distressed that the perpetuating stories she attempted suicide with pills. And this action on her part led to a premature labor, and her Caucasian girl baby died 2 days after being born in August of 1970. Both Gary and Seberg sued the various publications which had picked up the damaging rumor and received minimal damages for the legal efforts. After that, according to Gary, each year on the anniversary of the baby's stillbirth, the perpetually depressed actress attempted suicide. Well, she continued movie making throughout the early to mid-70s, none of which added to her laurels, including her last, A Wild Duck, in 1977. By that point in time, she developed a severe drinking problem that made her appear bloated at times. Married film director Dennis Berry in 1972, but they separated in 78. The next year, she married a young Algerian, Ahmad Hosni, in Paris. However, because of her divorce from Berry had never been official, that new marriage wasn't legal. Less than 2 weeks before she died, she attempted suicide at a French train station by throwing herself on the tracks. Hosni, with whom she'd been arguing, rescued her in time. And according to Ahmed, he last saw Jean on August 30th when she left their Ludie Longchamp's apartment, naked under a blanket and carrying a bottle of barbiturates. September 8th, her white Renault car was found on the street near to her apartment. Her decomposing naked body was lying on the back seat of the car. An autopsy determined she died from a mixture of pills and alcohol, and she probably died the night she left her apartment. Well, the distraught actress left a farewell note for her son, Alexander, and said, "Diego, my dear son, forgive me. I can't live any longer. I can't deal with a world that beats the weak, puts down the blacks and the women, and massacres infants. Understand me, I know that you can, and you know that I love you. Be strong, your mother who loves you, Jean." She was buried September 14, 1979, in Montparnasse Cemetery in Paris. Her three ex-husbands and Ahmed Hosni were at the service, as was Jean-Paul Belmondo. To his dying day, a year later, Gary insisted the facts surrounding her death suggested foul play. He cited as evidence that the police later discovered a suitcase at her apartment containing her driver's license, which had been reported stolen months before, money and her eyeglasses, which she needed to drive. He also noted the liquor level of her bloodstream had been medically determined to be above the point where a person would fall into a coma. And because no liquor bottles were found in her car, the police ruled out the possibility she started drinking after she parked the car. Well, years have passed, and no satisfactory solution to the case has ever been reached. Quite often, cases like this eventually are solved because someone squeals, so to speak. Another high-profile case that we've talked about previously was Natasha Nikolavina Zakharenko Gurdin. You know her as Natalie Wood, who died in 1981. Well, when she died in November of 81, it was a shocking coda to a erratic life. Highly emotional both on and off the screen, she had gone through periods of great professional popularity and relative inactivity. Married the same man, Robert Wagner, twice. There's only one unique aspect of her highly charged love life during her decades in the movie colony. And there are a lot of complicated layers to Natalie Wood. There are also great ambiguities and contradictions concerning her sudden death, officially designated as accidental drowning. To this day, the case remains puzzling, further confused by the contradictory statements of the three individuals present on the night she died, especially by the later theories as to her death stated by the boat's captain, Dennis Davern. Since providing their statements to the police at the time of the tragedy, both Robert Wagner and Christopher Walken remained silent about that fateful weekend. Well, her death marked the fourth disastrous end to a co-star, Rebel Without a Cause, which was done in 1955. James Dean died in a car crash that same year. Nick Adams died of a drug overdose in 68, and Sal Mineo was murdered in 1976. Well, she was born in San Francisco in 1938 to Russian immigrant parents, Nikolai and Maria Kulov, who changed their surname to Gurdin when he became an American citizen. Maria had a daughter, Olga, by a previous marriage, and there would be a third daughter, Lana, born in 1946. When Natalie was four, she and her mother were among extras used for Happy Land, and filmed in 1943, which filmed on location in Northern California. Convinced her daughter had a potential screen career, Maria moved the household to Los Angeles and changed Natasha's name to Natalie Wood. Irving Pickle, who had directed Happy Land, remembered the expressive bright youngster when he was casting Tomorrow's Forever in 1945. Gave her a key role. By the time she was nine, she had co-starred in Miracle on 34th Street in 47 and sometimes earned $1,000 a week. Well, for the rigidly controlled Natalie, it wasn't a happy period. She said, I spent practically all my time in the company of adults. I was very withdrawn, very shy, and I did what I was told and tried not to disappoint anybody. I knew I had a duty to perform, and I was trained to follow orders. One of her more terrifying and prophetic movie-making moments occurred during the making of Betty Davis's The Star in 1952, when a script called for her to dive into the water. Director told Frightened Natalie he would use a double at the last minute, changed his mind, and instructed Wood to do the stunt. Well, she went into hysterics, and thanks to Davis's intervention, the double was employed for the shot. She had a terrific fear of the water, which made the story of her by herself trying to secure a dinghy to their yacht in the middle of the night kind of silly. The ex-child star went through an awkward adolescence in the mid-50s, but as a result of playing a mixed-up teenager in Rebel Without a Cause in 55 opposite James Dean, she was Oscar-nominated as Best Supporting Actress. And suddenly, she was a hot box office property, whose hectic romantic life ranged from dating Raymond Burr to Elvis Presley. Interesting, she dated Raymond Burr, who's... Her studio tried to manufacture an on- and off-screen romance between her and Tab Hunter, her co-star on The Burning Hills in 56 and The Girl He Left Behind in 56. But in real life, she'd fallen in love with young leading man Playboy Robert Wagner. They married in Arizona at the Scottsdale Methodist Church, December 28, 1957. Meanwhile, Natalie was shoved into big, if unsuccessful, movies such as Marjorie Morningstar in 58, and she and Robert Wagner co-starred in All the Fine Young Cannibals in 61. Well, by that point in time, the couple's dream marriage had fallen apart. Their relationship was not helped by her romance with Warren Beatty when the two of them were making a picture together. Well, Natalie Wood and Robert Wagner divorced in 62. Began a period of several highly chronicled romances for Natalie Wood. Early 60s, she blossomed into a major star. Oscar nominated for both Splendor in the Grass in 61 and Love with the Proper Stranger in 62, and played the lead in two major musicals, West Side Story and Gypsy. But by the mid-60s, her career had slipped again, and she made no movies between 66 and 69. In May of 69, she married British screenwriter agent Richard Gregson, and their daughter Natasha was born in September 1970. Her career rose briefly when she was one of spouse-swapping characters in Bob Carroll and Ted and Alice in 69. Then she announced her retirement, insisting, let's face it, acting is not really important. I know they're not going to send my latest movie up in a time capsule. In the summer of 71, she and Gregson filed for divorce, and a year later, she and Robert Wagner got remarried aboard his yacht, Rambling Rose, anchored off the Catalina Island. Well, between marriages to Natalie, Wagner also married again and had a child from that union. Natalie and Robert had their own child, Courtney Brooke, in 1974. Well, from the mid-70s onward, her best acting was done on TV. She and Wagner co-starred in The Affair in 1973, Cat on a Hot Tin Roof in 76 with Laurence Olivier, and guest on the pilot in 1979 of his series Heart to Heart. When questioned about her diminished screen career, she said, I'm a woman, a wife, a mother, and a working actress in that order. In 1980, she had the title role in The Memory of Eve Riker in an oversized TV movie. November 1981, she was co-starring in Brainstorm, a scheduled to make her stage debut in Los Angeles production of Anastasia in February of 82, while Robert was launching into the third season of Heart to Heart. But when William Holden, the one-time intimate of his co-star, Stephanie Powers, died in a drunken fall on November 16, 1981. Production on the teleseries halted while Powers coped with the tragedy. Robert spent several days comforting his co-star, which did nothing to soothe the highly jealous Natalie. Thanksgiving Day, November 26, 1981, the Wagners hosted an informal party. One of the guests was Christopher Walken, Natalie's co-star, and some insisted new romantic interest in Brainstorm. For some reasons, Walken's wife had returned alone to her family in Connecticut. Natalie invited Walken to spend Thanksgiving weekend with her and Wagner aboard their 55-foot cabin cruiser, the Splendor. February and November 27th, the three actors boarded a yacht at Marina Del Rey, skippered by a one-man crew. Dennis Davern and the quartet headed for Catalina Island. That evening, after anchoring, the four came ashore to Avalon in the yacht's dinghy, the Valiant, and after dinner, because of rough waters, Wagner decided to move the yacht to a safer mooring. Others remained ashore at a local hotel. The next day, November 28th, they returned to the Splendor, now anchored at Isthmus Cover. About 4 p.m., they went ashore in a dinghy for dinner, remained at the restaurant, drinking several bottles of wine. Reportedly, Natalie was both intoxicated and flirtatious with Walken. Once back on the yacht that night, the skipper retired, while Natalie, Robert, and Christopher continued, as one account has it, the festivities in the main cabin. About midnight, Natalie left to change clothes. A few minutes later, about 12 in the morning, Davern made his last rounds and noted the dinghy, the Valiant, was gone. He assumed Natalie must have taken the boat, as was her occasional custom to view the evening stars. When she didn't return the next few minutes, a concerned Wagner began to search for her in another boat. By 1 in the morning on November 29th, Robert requested the Harbor Patrol to scout for Natalie, and at 3:26 a.m., the Coast Guard was added to the search party. Helicopters joined in the search. 7:44 in the morning, her body, face down, is found floating beneath the water's surface about 200 yards from the isolated Blue Cavern Point. The Valiant, with four life jackets on board, was 200 yards away. From the evidence, it appeared she had never gone aboard the small craft that night. Because of scratches on her hands and wrists, it was concluded she had attempted to cling to the cove rocks before she drowned. Well, in the ensuing police investigation, it was decided after changing clothes, at the time of her death, she was wearing a blue nightgown, knee-length socks, and a red down jacket. She decided to go out on the 10-foot inflatable dinghy, maybe to go to the hotel on the shore. But while untying it, she had fallen, struck her cheek on the process, and fallen into the extremely cold water. She drowned, drugged down by her water-soaked jacket. Well, controversial L.A. County Coroner Thomas Noguchi was in charge of this much-publicized case, and his investigation of this freak accident brought forth the speculation that Wagner and Walken had argued that night, and Natalie may or may not have attempted to leave the boat to get away from the two antagonistic men. According to Noguchi in the book The Coroner in 1983, there's a lot of room left for further investigation. There was one witness to Natalie's mishap. Los Angeles businesswoman, whose own boat was anchored 300 feet from the Splendor, testified about midnight she heard a woman's voice, sounding quite sober, shouting for help. However, she soon heard another voice responding, "Take it easy, we'll be over to get you." And after that, nothing but silence. She assumed the matter was resolved satisfactorily. Natalie's gardenia-draped coffin was buried at Westwood Village Memorial Park, December 2, 1981. Her simple bronze marker plate says Natalie Wood Wagner. Among the celebrities attending her funeral were Fred Astaire, Rock Hudson, Laurence Olivier, Gregory Peck, Elizabeth Taylor, as well as Christopher Walken and Stephanie Powers. Three of Natalie's best friends, Hope Lang, Roddy McDowell, and author-screenwriter Tommy Thompson, delivered eulogies. Father Stephen Fitzgerald of the Russian Orthodox Church of the Holy Virgin Mary officiated at the brief service. In a will, she requested Wagner be appointed guardian of their daughter, Natasha. The father of Natasha was Richard Gregson, so that the three girls could be brought up together. Left $15,000 for his stepsister, Olga Veropayoff, and all her clothing and furs to his sister, Lana Wood. Much of her jewelry and interest in works of art, household furnishings, were bequeathed to Wagner, as well as a portion of her residual estate. The balance of the estate was to be held in trust for her parents and children. Well, after being shelved for several months, Brainstorm finally was completed, working around Natalie's unfinished scenes. When it released in 1983, it was a sad anticlimax to her lengthy acting career. Ironically, in the face of what happened a few years before her death, Natalie Wood was asked what she thought she would like when she grew old. She said, "I don't think I had that far." Was it murder or an accident? Certainly it wasn't suicide. She had too much to live for. Well, there's been a lot of discussion. I had the opportunity to meet Robert Wagner a few times. I found him a very personal individual. Being an author myself, and he was an author, we met at a book signing, interestingly enough. You know, the next one we're going to talk about is Ross Alexander. Became an actor, began his stage career at age 18. Appeared with Blanche Yerkane in An Intimate Madam, or Madame. His first screen appearance was in the Paramount Pictures, The Wiser Sex, in 1932. Gained his fame as a contract leading man at Warner Brothers. Supported Dick Powell and Ruby Keeler in two musicals, Flirtation Walk in 34 and Shipmates Forever in 35. And in the studio's all-star version of A Midnight Summer's Dream in 35, he played Demetrius. Well, it was such a promising beginning. Life took a turn for the worse for the Alexander. December 6, 1935, 4 months after his marriage to stage actress Alida Farrell, she shot herself in the yard at her home. She was unhappy by her failure to build her own screen career and by the fact that Ross was dating other women. Although he appeared in six programmers in 36, the studio was no longer grooming him for stardom. September of that year, Ross wed starlet Ann Nagel, with whom he had co-starred in three features. Exactly 4 months into his second marriage, he shot himself in his home near Hollywood. His despondency over Alita's death was the official reason for his suicide. His final picture was released several months after his passing. In this mediocre musical, he supported Ruby Keeler and Lee Dixon. Well, this next one was Don Red Barry. For those who don't recognize the name, in 1940, he was cast as a lead in The Adventures of Red Ryder. Born in Houston, Texas, he was a high school athlete selected for the Texas All-Stars of 1929. Already attended the Texas School of Mines, which is University of Texas at El Paso. Migrated to Los Angeles, where he worked for an ad agency. Fling at summer stock led him to an acting career. Played a high school student in the Cecil B. DeMille's movie, This Day and Age, in 33. Toured in a road edition of Tobacco Road. Came back to Hollywood and made his official movie debut in Night Waitress in 1936. Breakthrough roles came in 39 when he appeared in Only Angels Have Wings and played a fugitive in Wyoming Outlaw, one of Republic's Three Musketeers series. One of those musketeers was John Wayne. 1940, he was cast as a lead in The Adventures of Red Ryder. Was serial, and he was so popular, he was starring in several more entries of the Western series. Although he didn't have red hair, excuse me, playing the comic strip hero had his professional nickname of Red. By 1942, he had his own Western series at Republic, and the next 3 years, he was voted one of the top 10 Western stars in the Motion Picture Herald annual poll. Wanting more demanding assignments, in 49, he joined Robert Lippert's budget releasing company, where he frequently produced his own films. 1951, he moved over to TV, and went until 3 years later, he returned to filmmaking with the privately financed Jesse James Women, which really wasn't that successful. He continued in supporting roles in pictures while joining the cast of the TV series Sugarfoot in the late 1950s. Played a police detective on TV's Surfside 6 in 1960. Was Mr. Gallo and Mr. Novak in 1963. Made three westerns for 20th Century Fox in 65, one of which, Convict Stage, he also scripted. 1970, Don announced his return to making low-budget westerns and asked fans to send in loans to finance the project. Well, as you might guess, this never happened. He continued his supporting roles in films on TV and making guest appearances as Western film buff conventions. The feisty, short-statured Barry was noted as one of Hollywood's principal ladies' men. Despite being married three times, including actress Peggy Stewart, he dated some of Hollywood's leading ladies, ranging from Joan Crawford to Linda Darnell and Ann Sheridan. 56 and made headlines when he and All Cry Tomorrow co-star Susan Hayward were caught together early one morning at his home by his then-girlfriend, starlet Jill Germain. By 1980, he was separated from his latest wife, the mother of his two children. Late on the evening of July 17, 1980, the police were called to his North Hollywood, California home where he was having a domestic scuffle with his estranged wife. Well, after thinking, at least this is their story, that they had solved the situation, the police got back in their squad car and Barry came rushing out of the house, waving a .38 caliber revolver over his head. Before they could do anything about it, he shot himself. He was declared dead at 10 p.m. that night at nearby Riverside Hospital. His final film, Back Road, starring Sally Fields, released in March of 81. Well, so much for Red Ryder. And if you ever saw the movie Christmas Story with Ralphie, Red Ryder was the hero. And it was the Red Ryder rifle that he wanted, even though everybody said he'd shoot his eye out. Well, until tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.